The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome, Jerry McGinnis.
Good evening. Thank you, Susan. As Susan said, my name is Jerry McGinnis, and in addition to being a St. Joe's alum, I'm proud to be a member of the board of the Free Library Foundation. On behalf of the Free Library, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out tonight on a rainy evening. Very good persistence and determination in getting here. Your ongoing support of the library really does make a difference, and I'd like to thank in particular those of you who have been generous enough to make a donation in the past year to the library. As many of you already know, the Free Library is currently working hard to break ground for the new Parkway Central Library, which is scheduled for December of 2008, and really is going to be a transformational endeavor, which will not only bring you increased comfort in a new state-of-the-art facility, there's also going to be a brand new auditorium for events like this. It's also going to provide all members of the Philadelphia community with a much-needed creative and cutting-edge information center that is free and accessible to everyone. We encourage you to consider a gift to the campaign for the new Parkway Central to help us reach our groundbreaking goal, and we thank you in advance for your support. Before I introduce our special guest, please take a moment to silence your cell phones. I'd also like to remind you there will be a book signing upstairs immediately after the event, as Susan indicated. One of America's most outspoken and successful coaches, this year Phil Martelli led St. Joe's University men's basketball team to its first NCAA tournament since 2004, when Mr. Martelli was recognized as the consensus national coach of the year. In Don't Call Me Coach, Mr. Martelli compresses his three decades of experience into a 10-point lesson plan for life that will benefit anyone, and finally puts into print the compelling and captivating best of his many memorable speeches. Now, Phil, before I call you up, I just have one question. I'm kind of used to seeing Phil on the sidelines. He's pretty animated. He's obviously a great coach, has had tremendous success, and we're all proud, those of us who are affiliated with the university, that, you know, for the great job he's been doing. But as I pondered this event tonight, I just somehow couldn't quite picture you in a library setting. So maybe you can explain that as part of your remarks. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you. Two things occurred to me. I did an eighth grade graduation today, and whenever I speak to young kids, I ask them, and I don't want to embarrass any of them, and I say, don't raise your hand, but I'm going to make an assumption that you would all like to be better students. And if I could suggest as a teacher, and I teach basketball, as a teacher, if I could suggest to you that in the world that you live in, the world is way too noisy. We all know that. The world is just too noisy for young people, really. So my suggestion to them is that if they would like to be better students, so if these were eighth graders, and I would say to them, if you want to be a better student, you want to be a better ninth grade student, and it doesn't matter to me the subject, read. And the second thing would be, to slow the world down and to quiet the world down, read. I don't care what you read. I don't really care what you read, but you need to have something by your bedside so that you read 10 minutes a day, 15 minutes a day. I don't know the right period of time, but I would suggest to all of these young people that you read. And I forgot to tell them that today at the graduation, because I always review my talks in my head and say, what did I get across what I wanted to do, get across? And I felt that way. But then as I was here, I was thinking, you know what, I forgot that. I forgot about, you know, it's a summer vacation and we all need to learn every day, and I forgot to mention that. And then the second thing that came to mind addresses Jerry's point. I am the oldest of seven. I used to live in Southwest Philadelphia in a row home, and like many of you, you go back to these houses and you think, where did all these people go? Where did they come from? It wasn't a shoe, but how did we get from all these places? And yet one of my vivid recollections is my mother would line us up, and I was the oldest, and my sisters were all behind me. And it was a momentous day in our home when you got your library card. And we went to the Paschal Library, and we would walk from 66th and Buist over to Paschal. And it seems to me, and I don't have a great memory, but it seems to me that that was a once-a-week occurrence. And I always remembered in the mass of confusion that would be big families, oldest of seven, my mother always took time to read. And that was my exposure to it. And really, when I look for calm, other than during the season, because I get too jumpy during the season and I can't really read, but now, all the time, I have something in my hand because I just want it to be quiet. I just want everyone, and there's probably people that hear me talk so much and they think, yeah, we'd like you to be quiet too. But that's certainly a setting that I enjoyed. And I have that recollection. And my mother to this day, I will finish and send something to her once or twice a week that she will pick up and read with great fervor. Did I ever expect to write a book? And the answer would be no. And I do have a checklist in my head. I know there's a movie out, The Bucket List, and things that you would like to do. And there were always things that I would like to do. I always wanted to own a bar, and I did, because I thought that was the ultimate people business. I always wanted to ride a motorcycle, and I never have. And I've been to Bermuda several times, and my wife would say, well, you always say that, but then you never did this. I always wanted to be the coach of the St. Joe Hawks. And Kathy is here. She was my grade school great friend. And when we were 13 years old, I turned to a guy in the schoolyard in Delaware County, and I said, one day I'm going to be the coach of the St. Joe Hawks. I didn't know what that meant. I really didn't know what it meant. I thought you got a suit, and you yelled at referees, and you did television every once in a while. But I never really knew what that meant. So I do have and have had a checklist, but book wasn't on the list. And the way this book came about was unannounced. Dr. Hal Gullin, who is a presidential, now this is really specific, you have to follow this. He is a presidential museum historian. So if you want to know the best handicap access presidential museum, he knows the answer. The one with the best parking, he knows the answer. The one with the best concessions, he knows the answer. The one with the most realistic view of their White House, he knows the answer. He's been to all these museums, and he has this checklist. And I started off in the book in acknowledging him and saying that he was a bit eccentric, and he took that the wrong way and said, could you change the wording? And I changed the wording. I don't know exactly what I called him, but a very, very, very interesting guy. And he showed up unannounced in my office, which happens all the time. And he came in and he said to me, I want to do an autobiography. And I laughed. And I said, about what? There's nothing here. I haven't done anything. I'm a basketball coach. And I don't have any really interest in you doing an autobiography for me or ghostwriting it or anything like that. I really don't have any interest. And he left. He up and walked out of the office. He came back, and I think it was 3 or 4 or 5 weeks later. And he sat in my office until I saw him, and he said, I want to do the 03-04 season. Now, the 03-04, I had the best team in America. We didn't win the national championship, but best team. That's the combination to me of talent and understanding, respecting the game, and not letting get to you. And they certainly made their families proud. They made our university very, very proud, and they did a terrific job. They set the standard, in my opinion, for what college teams will be measured against for a very, very long time. And he came in and he said, I want to do the 03-04 season. And I said, I'm sorry. I gave those rights. I didn't sign anything, but word to word, I gave those rights to Dick Girardi from the Philadelphia Daily News, and Dick literally has boxes and boxes and boxes of team meetings and notes that he took during that season and access that many people couldn't get. I gave him that access because that year we won our first game of the year against Gonzaga at Madison Square Garden. The next day, was my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, and for those from the area, we were having Mass at St. Francis de Sales in West Philadelphia. And as I was walking up the steps on a Saturday to go into Mass for my parents, the phone rang, and it was Dick Girardi. And he said, "Something special is about to happen this year. Let's do a book." And I said, "Okay." And that was the rights that I gave him. So when Hal showed up and said, "I want to do 0304. And I said, "I'm sorry, I gave those rights away." And he went away. I give talks about 100 to 150 times a year. And I've done a little bit of everything. For those of you old enough to remember, like, corner phone booths where one person could fit in, if one person was opening that phone booth and they invited me, I would be there. If kids in the neighborhood were having a mud fight and they wanted somebody to kick off the mud fight, I have been there. I have done career days, and I've done just about every high school in the Delaware Valley. I've done Fortune 500 companies. I was on the 42nd floor, and I feel badly using I all the time, but I was on the 42nd floor of the Comcast building yesterday speaking to their personal development department, and today I did an 8th grade graduation, and sometimes they miss this in my introduction. I have 2 doctorates. Now, anybody in this room, I have great admiration for anybody in the room that has a doctorate or is pursuing a doctorate, but you're not telling the truth. You tell people how much it cost you and how much time it took you. I have one from Widener. That was 12 minutes in length that I got that doctorate. And I spoke at Cabrini for 22 minutes, and I got a doctorate there. So I have 34 minutes worth of doctorate. And ironically, I never write anything down except the 2 commencement addresses that I gave. I have themes that run through my head, and I present stories that a lot of times people say, "That didn't really happen," and those things have happened to me. So he was in my office 3 or 4 weeks later, maybe even a little longer than that, and he had in his hand the commencement address that I gave at Cabrini. And he buttered me up at first, and he said, "This is one of the best commencement addresses that I've ever read." And I thought, "Yeah, okay, right. What's next?" And he said, "Let's do this address as a book." And I thought about it for a little bit, and I said, "Go ahead, what else you got?" And he said, "I want to take this address and go through some of these points, and I want people to feel when they read your book that you and they just had a cup of coffee, had a beer, rode in a car for a couple of hours." And I said, "I'm in." And then what happened would be, I would say to him, "I have 1 hour on Wednesday." And he would come in and he would have his list of questions, and we would sit for 1 hour, and he would ask the questions and I would answer, and then he would transcribe what I answered, and then he would hand it back to me and say, "Let's put this into a chapter." And maybe it would be my upbringing. Maybe it would be the television show. Maybe it would be some experiences that I've had through basketball. And then I would hand it back to him. And we did that probably over 15 to 18 meetings. And then there were people that he reached out to. He reached out to my mother and father. He reached out to my wife and daughter. He did not reach out to my sons. He didn't reach out to any former players. And he would come up with kind of a direction that he wanted to take the next questioning in. At some point, and my young friend right here asked me outside, "If I can't call you coach, what do I call you?" At one point, he said to me, we were probably 2/3 of the way through, maybe 3/4 of the way through, and he said, "How about a title?" And I said, "Oh, we have to pick a title." And I said, "Well, how about Don't Call Me Coach?" And I explained my reasoning to him, and then he left. And then 2 days later, I don't know why it occurred to me, but John Wooden, who is the greatest coach in any sport ever, has a book, They Call Me Coach. And I started to worry a little bit that maybe people thought I was being disrespectful to John Wooden. And I didn't want that, but I didn't really have it as a high priority to change the title of the book. The book is titled that way for 2 reasons. The first reason The first reason, don't call me coach, is I don't know how many of you know athletic coaches, and I'm talking about any age, any gender, but I'm more specific to college basketball coaches or people around college basketball. And what happens is they all put on a sweatsuit and they wear a whistle, which I have never done in my career. I don't use a whistle. I want the players to respond to my voice, so I only use my voice. But people gather a group of kids together, they put on a sweatsuit, put on a whistle, and then they say to everybody, call me coach. And in my opinion, they missed the point, because coaching is just people business. It's just dealing with people. So having to ask somebody to call you coach is a bit, you're overwhelming with what you do. You're overwhelmed with what you do and not who you are. So I did part of the title, tongue-in-cheek, at my colleagues. And seriously, at the Final Four, there's thousands and thousands. Everybody that coaches any team comes to the Final Four, whether they're looking for a new job, they're creating an old job, whatever it is, they're all over the place. And if you stood on the second floor in the lobby of the main hotel and yelled, coach, I know that one year one of these guys is going to end up like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. They're going to spin around so fast their neck is going to break. But they all want to be noticed for what they do, not who they are. And I will be honest with you, I blank out. I blank out. When I'm in that setting, and a young guy will come up to me trying in a way to impress me, and he'll come up and he'll start, coach, you know, what do you think about this? And I'll think, I just blanked you out, because you're not really interested in Phil Martelli. You're interested in this title, and you're trying to get something from this title that I'm not really that interested in giving you. And I really do. I have an ability where I'll just blank out and think, I don't even know what that guy talked to me about. Now, there are certain guys who have reached the ultimate, and I address them as coach. But my bottom line is, none of us go to school and get a degree in coach. Doctors can call each other doctor, but you don't see that in other professions. And so why do we take ourselves so serious, and why don't we take the time to find out who we really are, not what we do? Because at the end of the day, what we do is insignificant. Who we are is the essence here. So part of the title was that way, tongue in cheek. The second part of the title was, I want everyone and anyone who reads the book, whether it be a seventh grader, a CEO, a mom, a dad, a guy who makes your cheesesteak, guy that delivers the rolls, the guy that drops off your newspaper, whomever reads this book, at the end of the book, I honestly believe that no matter what your title, whatever you do, you're a coach. You're a coach. So why shouldn't I call you that? And you might say, well, I don't want them to talk about me on WIP the way they talk about coaches. Okay, that's fair enough. I understand that. But really, coach / teacher / leader, it's the same for all of us. And I bet if we went to everybody in this room, these are a couple of points about coaching. First and foremost, everybody in this room today built on a relationship. Everybody did it. That's exactly what I've done all day long. Built on a relationship. The only suggestion that I make is everybody in here has been approached by a young person to say, help me out. Help me out. Can you get me into the airport for work? Can you get me into the post office? They line up at my door. Coach, can you help me out? I really want to become a coach. And we always say the same thing to them. Who do you know? Who's your mentor? Who's your guru? Who's your godfather? We never, ever ask them, what was your grade point average? What honor society might you have entered into while you were in college? Which activities did you participate in while you were in high school? We don't ask them that. We ask them, who do you know? I would suggest that we expand that in building relationships and say, what do you know about those that you know? And from my experience, and this story is in the book, when I was a second-year high school coach, I was 23 or 24 years old, and I had sent out a memo stating that I was a certifiable genius with regard to basketball and interpersonal relationships. And I had a young guy on my team, and the young guy was standing there on the court, and I said to him, change the defense from brown to blue. And he ignored me. And I said it a second time, and he ignored me. And I said it a third time, and he ignored me. And I did what all of you would do. I took him out of the game, and I ripped into him, and it didn't put him back in the game. The next day at home, my phone rang, and his mom said to me on the phone, do you know my son? And I answered her question three times. She asked me the same question in the same tone three times. The fourth time, I started to get it a little bit, and I said, what is your point? And the fifth time, she only asked me one question, and she asked me five times in the same tone of voice. After the fifth time, I said, can we get to the point here? You're upset about playing time. You're upset that I took your son out of the game. But what is your point? She said, you've answered that you know my son. And I said, yes, I did. And yes, I do know your son. And she said, what way was my son facing when you called out to him? And I recreated it in my mind, and I said, he was facing left to right. She said, you know my son so well. You know he's deaf in his left ear. He never heard you. Build relationships. What do you know about those that you know? Everybody in here built a relationship today, or will. So to me, what you do and what I do is the same. So why shouldn't I call you coach? Everybody in here in some way, shape, or form today organized their day, or organized their people, or organized their concept. You might use a different method than I use. I am notorious for the phone. I love the phone. I love calling myself, leaving myself messages. Let's get this done tonight when I go home. I have a whole list of things. When I leave in the morning, I call my office. I leave all these things that I want to get done. And it keeps me comfortable and organized. You might have another method. You might be a Palm Pilot or a BlackBerry or a note taker, and I'm a notorious note taker. But everybody in here organizes. And in order to be successful at whatever the title you have, we do the same thing. So why shouldn't we call you coach? That's the way that I look at that. Now, I will suggest this to you. This attempt to be organized nearly cost me a 30-year marriage. My wife wanted to move from Drexel Hill, 8 minutes from my office, not that I was counting, to Media, 26 minutes to my office. And she wanted to move, I thought, for a very selfish reason. She wanted to move so she could have a larger master bathroom so that she could sit down. And I would say, like, what do you need a larger master bathroom for? And she said, well, to do my hair. And I said, well, I think that's selfish because I do my hair the night before I go out. And I don't know why you couldn't do the same thing. But like all of you, I'm where I am because my family has sacrificed for me. And I felt that it was appropriate. But to stay organized, the cell phone had three dead spots on Route 1 from Media to 54th and City Line. And I mulled this over, and I mulled this over, and finally went to Circuit City, and I bought myself a dictaphone. So when I drive down Route 1, when my cell phone goes dead, I pick up the dictaphone and talk to myself. How do you organize? And however you organize, you coach, you teach, you lead. So why shouldn't I call you coach? The third thing that everybody in here did today is you did something with energy. You cheered for the Red Sox today with energy, did you not? So everybody, what we're responsible to do, in my opinion, for each other, is to create an energy around either the activity or the plan that we're putting in motion. That's what I talk about. And there's an unbelievable story in the book about knowing in 03-04 when I knew I had a great team. And it was on a street corner in Jersey City, New Jersey, when I took this whole group of 18 to 22-year-olds to a viewing for one of our players who had not only lost his father when he was in ninth grade, but lost his mother when he was a freshman in college. And I took them all up there. And I watched these young guys provide somebody energy when they needed it the most, when he needed it the most. And if I could create in your minds a picture of energy, what I think we're all responsible to do, I think in every way, shape, or form, in every situation that we're in, I think we're all asked to extend our hand and touch each other's hearts. And if you think about the times in your life that you extend a hand, somebody's down and you reach to pick them up. You meet somebody and you extend a hand. You're closer than that and you want to hug. You want to celebrate and you give a high five. In all of those cases, when you extend your hand, you're touching the other person's heart. You're providing energy. So if you've done that today, and I know you have, if you've done that today, then what you've done today and what I've done today is the same. So if you're here with the title of brother, of mom, of granddad, of CEO, whatever title you came in with, I'm going to suggest from this book that you coach. That you coach. So we do the exact same thing. And I have never, ever, ever, with accolades and pats on the back and records that we've set, I've never, ever thought that what I did was extraordinary. I understand it. There's 300 jobs like mine in America. And I understand that, and I respect the fact that people want to make it more than it is. But I'm much more comfortable being Phil Martelli. And who I am, and remembering where I came from. This book has a lot, it's not dedicated to, but there's a lot about my father. And my father, for you, those old enough, my father is Peter Falk in Columbo. That's exactly my father. He kind of bumbles along, and you think, is he really getting this? Is he with it? You know, where is he exactly? Today I met my father at a Dairy Queen in Lansdowne to give him two tickets to the Phillies game today. And I have this system now in my car where you don't have to have any hands. You can speak into your radio. And I was talking to a guy from the NBA about a prospect. And my father puts his head in the car, takes the tickets, and starts talking to me in this way. Who are you talking to? What's going on? I said, Dad, this is a business call. Well, who are you talking to? Well, how's this work? But that's what he does. That's what he does. There's an awful lot in the book about my grandfather. And my favorite story about my grandfather is I got engaged when I was a senior in college. And after a couple of days, my wife, Judy, said to me, there's just one thing about this engagement that maybe you missed, but there's supposed to be a ring involved here. And I was like, oh, okay, so how do you do that? Like, what do you do? And I went to see my grandfather who lived in Grays Ferry, and I said, Pop, listen, I got engaged the other day, and I'm a little bit, I don't really have the money. I don't have I don't have any idea how to do this. And my grandfather went down the basement and came walking back up, and he peeled off 9 $100 bills. Now, I'm not saying he didn't print them in the basement, but he came up with 9 $100 bills, and then he sent me to see his guy. And in the book, I talk about, if you're from Philadelphia, everybody has a guy for something, and we never, ever went in the front door of any store. It was always in the back up to the third floor, and they would say, well, this is stuff that you didn't, you're not going to find on the showroom floor. And that's the way that I got my wife's engagement ring around the back of a jewelry store and literally knock a certain time, repeat what he said. And so there's an awful lot about my grandfather. There's an awful lot about my father. And that I'm really delighted. I have a brother and five sisters. And I would suggest if you're going to do a book, just be really careful, because all six of them counted how many words they were mentioned in the book and could tell me who got more words than somebody else. Not the description that I gave of them, but really what, how many words and what order. And I did it chronologically, so I knew that they would come after it. There were a lot of unbelievable experiences with the book, and I will be the first to tell you. If I could go backwards in time and say, okay, let's stop for a second, and what don't I like about the book? I have a unique television show in that most college shows, football or basketball, the coach doesn't want to be there. And he kind of stares at the camera, and it's a deer in a headlight, and they talk about the wonderful student athletes that they have and the great experience that they can. And really, they're just looking for it to end, whether it be a 30-minute show or an hour show. And I don't see it that way. When we decided to do a television show at St. Joe's, I said, we're going to do this so that the person with the remote would stop and say, what's going on? Once you establish the fact that the show is a little bit offbeat, enough. But Hal, and no disrespect to Dr. Gullen, but he kind of wanted to keep going and keep going and keep going. And I'll be honest, I just don't think it's that funny after you've done it, and now you read a couple of pages about, well, to turn around a losing streak, Phil one time did the television show from a casket. Okay. So, that's true. We did do it. But we did a little bit too much of that. I would like there to have been more of the sense of any success, and all successes that I've had are through these players and these fans and this administration. And I would like there to have been more of that sense and feel of engagement with them in the book. My young friend asked me out front, what am I supposed to call you? So I'll finish with this one story. And then, Susan, are we all right time-wise?
Yeah.
Okay. Right after the book came out, I like to go to the office on Saturday and Sunday because it's a little bit quieter in the field house. And I was walking through the field house, and it was a typical day where I had multiple things that I wanted to get done. And as I walked through the field house, an 18-year-old came walking past me. And the kid said, hey, coach. And I said, how you doing? I'm doing, hope you have a great day. And I walked to the car, and I had a pile of stuff in my hands. And I went to put the things in my back seat, and this kid came sprinting. And I could hear somebody running, and I kind of turned around. It was the same kid who had just come through the field house. And he said to me, I'm really, really, really sorry. I'm so sorry. And I looked at the kid, and I said, well, what happened? What are you sorry about? He said, well, I know the book just came out this week, and you don't want us to call you coach. So I'm just wondering, should I call you Mr. Martelli? Should I call you Phil? And I'm standing there, and I'm thinking, I'm probably 10 minutes from being 20 minutes late for my next appointment. Do I explain the title of the book to my young friend here? Or do I kind of say to him, I said, look, here's the deal. I'm old enough to be your father. You can call me coach, but don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody else. But it's probably not appropriate that you use my first name, and Mr.'s too formal. So you only can call me coach. This was in October. And for the rest of the year, when I would see this kid, and our campus is so small, and the kid actually worked in the field house all year long as a work study, when he would see me coming, he would do this. Like he didn't see me because he didn't know what to do. He didn't know what to say. And so I appreciated the question that you asked me. And we're going to get to that. But I didn't do it to be irreverent. I didn't do it so that everybody would say, oh, well, Al McGuire, when he was alive, had people call him Al. And Joe Paterno, who is going to coach until the very last day of his life, I would assume, has the players call him Joe. That's not why I did it. And I haven't had any situations with my players. But everywhere that I go, I am asked about the title of the book. And I do appreciate people's interest in the book. Before I take questions, let me just suggest this to you. I see my job three-pronged. Coach my current team. Recruit my future teams. And I do both of those things every day. But I think the third thing that I'm responsible for is to do public relations for St. Joseph's University. They gave me a chance when a lot of only one place interviewed me and they told me I wasn't good enough for their job. So I do take being in public and doing what I can for individual schools or communities or churches or charitable endeavors, I take that very personal. The only thing I would ask you to do is do not email me. And I am going to vote in November on the first candidate that tells us email is fraud. Because they tell you how fast it is. But here's what happens. You email me. My secretary reads it and prints it. She hands it to me. I read it. I handwrite my response, and I hand it back to her. She then types back to you. That's not fast. But if you call me, I will answer, or I will call you right back, and we can get to the business of business. If I can do anything for your families, your churches, your charitable endeavors, your communities, please feel free to call. And if I can fit it into my schedule, I guarantee you I will do the very best I can, because I do take it very, very personal about representing St. Joseph's University all over the Delaware Valley. And I'm ready for any questions. And you're first. You don't even have to stand up.
I do because I'm a little tiny.
Oh, he wants me to use the microphone. Okay. With 2 degrees, I am extending to myself the privilege of calling you Dr. Martelli.
Thank you very much.
Tell us, if you don't mind, when you're coaching, you must be teaching these kids life's lessons. I want to compliment you on your grammar. I come from a family of English teachers, and it grates on my ears when I hear television anchor people use incorrect grammar, and your who's and whom's have been perfect all the way through. And that is possibly a tribute to St. Joseph's, but whatever. But I am interested. You just don't tell them to go in and do this turn, that turn, shoot the basket here, there, or something. You are teaching them all the time. Talk about that if you
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I don't want to offend anybody. I went to the best high school in America. I went to St. Joe's Prep. It's the best high school in America. And my mother is of the opinion, and I would never disagree with my mother. My mother is of the opinion that St. Joseph's Prep teaches you two things for sure, to public speak and to write. So I do take time on both of those matters. So I appreciate you mentioning that. I think my teaching has a lot more to do with non-basketball issues. And I've never thought of myself as this basketball guru. And John Chaney had a zone defense, and the Princeton coach, Pete Carril, had an offense. I've never thought of myself in that way. What I try to do in my teaching with my players is, first and foremost, we have one rule in our program. Be on time. And being on time to me is the ultimate sign of respect. And if I can get them to understand respect, we can work on all of the other things. And if you're not entitled to my money, you're not entitled to my time. So it's really very simple. We say to our players, 8 o'clock is 8 o'clock. And if you're there at 8:01, well, today you lose the opportunity to be taught or to teach me. Because I do think that they have to teach me every day also. So to me, being on time is the ultimate sign of respect. And that's where I start. I think it's very, very important. And I would suggest this to you, because I think it's a jump when you use newscasters. One of the things that I look for, and we spend time with our players, is how they're interviewed in the media. Because to me, 6 million people are giving you a job interview every time you're on the air. And so we work really hard on the pauses, the ums, the ye knows, and that kind of thing. And for those that are basketball fans, I think that what Boston did last night was incredible. They played beautiful basketball. I think their celebration made them look like complete fools. I really do. I don't think it was the true celebration of a championship. I think it was something other than that, and I don't understand it. I really don't understand it, because they're the top of their profession and there should have been this sense of celebration. So we do spend time on media appearances with our players. But the number one thing, I think most schools do that now. I honestly believe that, and it's part of our responsibility. We could teach them all we want in the classroom and on the court, but there's a whole lot of socialization that is really important. And then I would say the next rung of our teaching is that idea of respect. And in my opinion, we live in a society today where we've lost that. I mean, the use of foul language, the disrespect that does go on. To me, to get respect, you have to first give it. And that's what we talk to our players about, respecting the game, respecting your opponents, respecting the teachers, the coaches, the referees. So I do think that my responsibility is to make them be terrific players. And if they can pursue it as a lifelong career, great. But over here, they're young men. And what I ask their parents is, trust me, and I'm going to hand you back a man.
Yes, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much.
And I appreciate you coming. My question refers to the NBA with the referee, you know, how he fixed games and everything, because I want to pick your brain on this, because this could be a potential problem with possibly other referees, and I think David Stern is taking this lightly because he's trying to treat this as an isolated incident, and I think that he needs to really check his referees, like he really emphasized on checking his players. What's your view on that? And my other question is, I read your book about, you mentioned like one of your sisters has more athleticism than you do, and I wonder, was there any challenge with Big Brother, how she would probably want to be more dominant than you or take that next level? And a third question is, I remember 1995 when you got snubbed for a challenge after a snow delay, and that coach didn't want to reschedule you because I guess you're small St. Joe's, you know, you're nothing, but you really proved yourself, as you can see. And I want to know what you think about major coaches that really snubbed you and think that your school is small and don't want to re-challenge the deserve you deserve to be challenged.
Okay. The answers to your questions, yes, no, maybe. I'm only kidding. The referee situation. I believe, and I should say this, the area that I lived in Drexel Hill is where this referee is from. I know his father very, very, very well. His uncle is a former St. Joe player and was an NBA referee. In my opinion, what he did was what has happened in every living room and corner bar forever about the NBA. We have all heard they want every series to go seven games because they make more money. Now, I don't know if that's true or not true, but we've all said it or we've all thought it. Second thing is, don't watch an NBA game until there's 2 minutes left. Now, my point would be that with David Stern in charge of the NBA, I don't see anything that happens to them that is at all haphazard. They wanted a worldwide initiative, they have a worldwide initiative. They wanted a women's professional league, they have a women's professional league. And just keep going. They wanted the developmental league, they have a developmental league. I believe that the scrutiny that those referees are under, and to think that three could get in cahoots to make something happen, I just don't want to believe it. I think that what this young guy is doing is, in desperation, he's just going to fire every bullet that he has, and if somebody gets clipped, it's not really going to be an impact. Somewhere along the line, there's an imbalance, there's a concern, and what I have a problem with is that it overshadowed. These finals will always be remembered for that type of innuendo accusation that was made. With regard to the cancellation, what happened in my first year at St. Joseph's, We had a year, if you can remember, in 96, we had this snowstorm to end all snowstorms. We had 36 inches. Now, what happened to us was we were in Blacksburg, Virginia, about to play Virginia Tech. And I was a first-year coach, and I was convinced that everybody was going to push around this first-year coach. And we were supposed to play Virginia Tech at Virginia Tech. The phone rings. I pick up the phone, and the guy introduces himself. This is Joe Smith. I'm assistant athletic director in charge of events at Virginia Tech. Today's game is canceled. And I said, is that right? You know who you're talking to. What do you mean today's game is canceled? He said, Coach, calm down. Are you at the Holiday Inn across the street? I said, yes, I am. I said, you're not canceling any game. I'll tell you when we're going to cancel the game. Did the league call and cancel the game? He said, Coach, are you on the first floor? I said, yes, I am. He said, Coach, open your drapes. And I had a sliding door, and the snow was three-quarters of the way up the sliding door. That was on a Saturday. We never got out of Blacksburg, Virginia, until Monday at about 2 in the afternoon. Nothing moved. Nothing. We ran out of food at the hotel. There was nothing going on, going in or out. We left Blacksburg to come to Philadelphia on a yellow school bus because that was a Monday. On Wednesday night, we were supposed to play the number one team in the country, UMass, in a league game. We left on a Monday. On I-95, the driver pulls into the rest stop in Delaware, and he turns to me and he said, that's as far as I can go. And I said, well, wait a second. We're 50 minutes from campus. What do you mean this is as far? He said, no. Delaware and Pennsylvania are in a state of emergency. Only priority vehicles can be on the road. So I sat there and I looked at the guy and I said, how much is the fine if you get stopped? He said, it's $1,300. I said, go ahead, I'll pay the fine. And this is a true story. This guy pulled up in front of the field house, dropped us, and took off as fast as he could to get back out of the two states. We went in, we tried to practice. It was maybe 10, 11 o'clock at night. While we were practicing, John Calipari was the coach of UMass. He called me, and he said, we're not coming. UMass is under state of emergency. We're not allowed to come. So the game was moved from Wednesday to Thursday. We lost that night in overtime to the number one team in the country. I went home, and I was trying to unwind, and Arizona was on TV against Arizona State. We were on national TV against Arizona Saturday afternoon at the Palestra. And I was watching this broadcast, and I was half awake and half alert, and I heard this announcement that Arizona stated that their game on Saturday in Philadelphia had been canceled by mutual agreement. So I went in to the office the next day, and I called the athletic director, and I said, no, you know what I was doing? I was making settlement on a house that I was moving to in Drexel Hill, and I was in settlement. And I kept saying, I have to go. I have to make a phone call. I'll be back. And I went out and I said, did anybody make an agreement with Arizona without telling me? No, we didn't. So we started to call their office. They ignored us. And in a way, it was disrespect because they were a big school and we were this little school. And it was disrespectful. So to turn the tables, what happened is on the day of the game, at the time of the game, I took my team to the Palestra. We introduced the starting lineups. And we had a jump ball. And then we ran a perfect play. And it took us about 35 seconds to score on nobody. And we scored and we declared ourselves the winner 2-0. Now, I thought it would be cute. To be honest with you, I thought it would be cute. I thought maybe like 3, 6, and 10 would show up. Well, the national media was there. And I thought, okay, big mouth, you put yourself in this position. Let it rip. And I did. I've never spoken to Lou Dolson. He's never spoken to me. And I've never spoken to him. But in a way, it's this whole idea, like, well, you're a coach, so you should... You don't get a free pass on that. You don't get a free pass on that. So a lot of those guys that you see on television and they give them nicknames, I consider those guys... One of my closest friends is Jim Boeheim. He's one of my closest friends. My closest friend in life is Gino Auriemma, the coach from the University of Connecticut. So, again, I don't take a back seat. And I'd like to know these guys on a one-on-one basis, but that's one of the reasons that I've kind of ignored him. And I forgot your first question. My sister. Yeah, my sister ran marathons. My sister ran marathons, And she also, she's the assistant director of the Chamber of Commerce in Chester County. But before she goes to work every day, she gets up at like 5 in the morning and teaches at LA Fitness on Westchester Pike, and she suggests that I should stop by there every once in a while. And I tell her, I have a treadmill in my basement. I'm okay. About 7:30, I go down to my treadmill. So, yeah, I have a brother who's a genius, really tested out as a genius, and he went to the University of Chicago, and in his second year, he took a test, and the teacher gave it back to him and said, this is B-minus work. And my brother said to him, that's your opinion. I didn't come here for your grade. I came here for knowledge. That was the last class that he was allowed to take at the University of Chicago.
How old was Jameer Nelson when you realized he was going to be the player he was in 2004? And do you see another one on the horizon?
I wish.
I got a cousin.
You have a cousin? I hope he got the height in your family. I might have to take you on the road with me. I saw Jameer Nelson when he was 16 years old. He was playing at Villanova. My assistant coaches had seen him play, and they said that when I asked about him, they said he was too small. And I said, well, let me just take a look. Let me see what I think. And I went to Villanova, and they were playing... Chester High School was playing, I think it was Pensbury, in the District 1 final. And as I was sitting watching him play, he scored no points and took one shot in the first 16 minutes of the game. And I was mesmerized. And I kept saying to myself, I'm watching, if I can get this kid to come to St. Joe's, I'm watching the greatest guard that will ever have played at the school. And the game ended, and they won the champion, won the District 1 championship, and I went up to his coach, and having gone to Widener, I knew most of the people from Chester who were involved in basketball. And I said to the coach, I said, I'm really disappointed. We're friends, and you told me about this kid when he was in ninth grade, but you told me he was good, and he's great. And I was convinced on that day that he could make the biggest of difference, and that's exactly what he did. The decision that he made to come back to school and the promotion that we put behind him, but his play really led him to be the National Player of the Year. And I'll give you a quick story about that. Jameer received the Atlanta Tip-Off Club's Player of the Year on Good Friday night. And I received the National Coach of the Year award at the same dinner. They had a police escort to take us to the airport to go to L.A., and the next day we were going to find out if he received the John Wooden Award. He was one of the five finalists for the John Wooden Award. They took us to the airport. We got on the plane. It was myself, Jameer, Don DeJoy, our athletic director, Marie Wozniak, our sports information director. The four of us were walking through LAX on our body time now. It was about 4 or 5 in the morning. And it was maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning in L.A. There was no one in the terminal. And we were walking through the terminal, and there were three guys over here doing cement for a new concession stand. And we got to that door, and these three guys in broken English stood and yelled, St. Joseph's, St. Joseph's, because of one little kid. Because of a kid who was 5'10", they knew about our school in LAX. I saw things that I would never, ever believe. I saw a guy driving a car rental van jump out of the van with the van still moving. He was the driver. He jumped out to get Jameer's autograph. He's and it's interesting because I always use the comment about Jameer. He's a much better person than he is a basketball player. And he's a multimillionaire now. And his mom would always call me when she would read that in the paper and say, well, what does that mean? Do you think he's not good in basketball? And I would tell her what I really meant. So he was extraordinary the first time I ever saw him. Sure thing.
One more question.
Sure.
Who do you think is the best basketball player that Philadelphia has produced?
Wilt.
question.
That was easy. Well, I will tell you this. I will tell you, this is an unusual, this is why I'm not a big proponent of the computer. I got called on the air last week, called out on the air on WIP last week, because they claimed that I had been on the air with Sonny Hill saying that Michael Jordan was the best, which I do believe, and that Kobe was now second. I never, ever uttered those words, and I had to spend 15 to 20 minutes defending myself, saying I've never thought anybody other than Michael Jordan 1, Wilt 2, and then I think there's a whole gap even between number 3, if you think it's Magic Johnson or Larry Bird or Jerry West or Oscar Robertson. But to me, it's Jordan and Wilt and then everybody else. Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Sure thing.
I want to know, like, how hard is it for, like, a person just getting into playing basketball? I think I can play, but what qualities and features do a coach look at when searching out a basketball player?
That's a great question.
I also want to know, like, how hard or common is it to find, like, a smart basketball player?
Mm.
Like, I saw the Temple versus the Hawks at the Leo Cora Centers, and the team looked, like, really coordinated and smart and spiffy and stuff. But when you guys are playing maybe an Ivy League team like Yale or Princeton or Harvard, like, is it different? Is, like, some kind of a fear, like, brawn versus brain?
Yeah. The first part of your question, when I go out to watch somebody play, I'm there because I have some idea that they have a skill set, that they're pretty good in basketball. So here's what I look for. First thing that I look for is a competitive instinct. Are they willing? Are they there that night to win? Because at our level, that's what matters. You're supposed to win. The second thing that I'm looking for is respect. Will they respect their coaches, the referees, their opponents, the game itself? The third thing that I'm looking for is somebody that doesn't have all the answers. And that's hard to find today. Because when they're very, very young, they're being told how good they are. So they believe they have all the answers. And if I can't coach them, there's no way that I can take them from good player to great player or from a good high school player to a guy that could potentially make money. So that's what I look for. So if we all went, there's about 100 of us, if we all went to a game and we said, okay, I'll meet everybody at Drexel. They're playing a summer league game tonight. I think we would go 95 for 100 and say, he's the best player. But that doesn't make him the most desirable to me. And then the second thing, you make a very, very good point, and I'm just going to tweak your point just a little bit. Practice is what gets you to that point of being coordinated, like you were kind enough to mention our team. One of the things that is of concern in today's game is the thinking of the game, because these players run faster, they jump higher, they can do more tricks with the ball than anybody ever thought of, but they don't all think the game. So sometimes when you face a system team, like a Penn or like a Princeton or like the Temple Zone when John Chaney was there, it is more of a challenge than if you just play five guys who are willing to run up and down and jump real high and don't really use the time and the score as part of the game. So you do make a very interesting point. I don't like to define it as, well, when we play the Ivy League, it's different. But when you play a system team as opposed to a bunch of guys just playing, that is more challenging. Certainly more challenging.
What do you prefer?
What do I prefer to play against?
No, in a player, period.
I prefer this.
What kind of games did you play as a kid in the neighborhood?
What neighborhood did you grow up in?
Amherst.
Step ball?
Yeah.
Wire ball?
Yeah.
Ledge ball? Box ball? Half ball? Hose ball? What else?
That's it.
And then when I moved to the suburbs, you know what game we played? We used to get the tennis courts and play tennis ball. So we would use a tennis racket and bounce the pitch in, but you couldn't hit it over the fence or it was an out. And, you know, to be honest with you, that's what they're missing today. That's what the kids are missing. They have no idea of neighborhood. They really don't. And they can't. You ever play baseball? Right field was an automatic out because you only had right pitcher out. Come on, they don't do it. They don't. They wouldn't have. They don't have any idea. And it's a shame. We've over organized them, in my opinion. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hello. Thank you so much. We're going to be having Phil will be signing books upstairs in the Homepage Cafe, and we're going to have reception there with coffee and desserts, and you're all invited. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
And I was really pleased. A lot of people from the library came, too.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.